Welcome to Table Talk on Disability Matters, where we continue the intentional conversations we started in person during 2015 on what matters to people with disabilities, their families, and support networks. We place the lens on the best of what is and explore the possibilities of what could be, while stimulating a different view on ability, diversity, and inclusion. Hello, and welcome to our podcast entitled Scattering My Ashes and Other Difficult Conversations. My name is Rose Flagg, and my intention is to offer you a discussion with some depth that will get you thinking about your own difficult conversations. In a previous table talk, the topic centered on upcoming changes to the Vulnerable Persons Act, the Pathways to Dignity report, based on the review by the task force, presented 16 themes with more than 80 recommendations to the Manitoba government. The recommendation around assisted decision-making and ways to improve facilitating such a support requires conversations. Conversations that we hope opens minds, that lead to open hearts, and generally a greater understanding in all areas of society. How do we help people who have an intellectual or cognitive disability that hinders them from functioning in a standard manner? Well, we've learned that one way is to keep helping them and encouraging them to make small choices, which lead to building the decision-making muscle for bigger choices, just as it happens within all of us. Some conversations take a little bit more time, though. They're sensitive, they may feel uncomfortable, and require observation to find the right moments. They are also the ones that we don't have very often. This table talk fits into that description. In this podcast, we cover topics that a lot of us find challenging. We share stories that demonstrate ways that others dealt with situations during difficult times and unexpected circumstances. You might think beginning such a conversation with a difficult topic could seem a little ambitious, yet why not just start somewhere? As you listen, you will learn that this topic covers a lifespan, and it means being open to the opportunities that present themselves. Although we are talking about assisting people with an intellectual disability, because that is part of the population we serve, let's face it, we have to do some self-reflection in our own journey to identify our own comfort, our own fears, and our own resistance. Leslie Udell does a great job talking about who and what is important when it comes to these difficult conversations. I invite you to consider taking a journey of curiosity. And as you listen, think about the possibilities of changing how we might view the difficult conversations and why we label them the way we do. Our inner contemplations are the original step in that journey of 1,000 steps. Regardless where we are on the continuum of a journey in supporting people, our inner journey is the one that sets the intention and tone. I do hope you enjoyed this discussion. Today on Table Talk, we're going to be talking with Leslie Udell about end of life and the planning that ought to come with it for people with an intellectual disability. We talk a lot about transitioning through the years of children moving from nursery school to public school, and then from the different stages in schools, middle, high school, and then finally into adult services. The one thing that often gets lost is the discussion around end of life, sort of left dead in the water, pun intended. So welcome, Leslie.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to having this conversation with you. Other than my asking you to have this discussion, talk a little bit about what brings you here and some of your experiences. I know you've worked in the field of supporting people with an intellectual disability, but you've also got a lot of other training and experiences and knowledge in the field. So talk away.
Well, as you mentioned, I've been involved in supporting people with intellectual disabilities for 35 plus or more years now. And I spent 30 years working in an organization and supporting people residentially and fairly quickly on. A number of the folks that we provided supports to, we recognize, wow, surprise, people are getting older. We hadn't planned for that. And then part of that process was that a few folks that we supported ended up being diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, another thing we knew nothing about. And quickly, the organization decided that it was important to support people right through end of life. And I just happened to be the person who was going to, you know, lead the charge in doing that, knowing nothing about that either. And I jumped in with both feet. I approached Palliative Manitoba, got information there, started reading whatever I could get my hands on, went to conferences where I would purposely sit in on sessions where people were beginning to work with folks with an intellectual disability around end of life and advanced care planning, and then just kind of ran with it. One of the things we identified early on is that we needed to help people capture what they wanted. What did they want in their funeral? What did they want at end of life? Who did they want to leave their valuables to? All conversations that had never been had with this particular group of people for a variety of reasons that I think we're probably going to get into. So that was some of my background. And through that, I also began offering the communication section of a couple of courses that Palliative Manitoba ran. So I got to be even more involved with Palliative Manitoba and understanding their perspectives and getting that information about end of life and advanced care planning. And then I became part of a support network. So many years later, after doing all this work and supporting people, I became part of a support network with this wonderful woman who unfortunately ended up with a rare autoimmune disorder that attacked her organs. And as part of that, kind of shut down her kidneys and then shut down her heart. And she ended up in ICU. The medication she provided her to keep her heart going drew blood from her extremities. And so within a fairly short period of time, both her hands and both her feet turned black. And as we continued to have conversations with the staff at the ICU, they indicated that even trying, and she was on a machine to, you know, operate her kidneys and clean, you know, do that piece because her kidneys weren't working anymore. And they said, we can take her off, try and take her off of the sedation we're giving her and the intubation and see how she does. But before we do that, we have to amputate both her feet, both her hands, and she will need kidney dialysis and a kidney transplant. What do you think? This woman didn't have a lot of family involvement. Her family didn't know her well. Fortunately, the support network consisted of people who knew her so well and had known her for a long time. But we had never had any discussions with this woman about, you know, what she might want at her end of life. And if it weren't for a fabulous ethicist at the hospital and this group of people who were so committed and knew this lady so well, I don't know what we would have done. But we did manage to come to a decision and we felt somewhat okay with it, but it was horrible because we didn't truly know what she would have wanted if she could have told us ahead of time, don't ever put me in this situation. So we were guessing. And that really solidified to me how essential and important it is to have this discussion with people.
Well, you raise, as I was listening to you, certainly raised the question immediately of around the stereotyping that we do when it comes to someone with a disability and why we have perceptions that give us the illusion that they're not going to understand. Mm. And you and I were just talking a few minutes ago about how the difficulty really comes to those of us who are supporting someone because we don't know how to handle what they can't handle or think mm-hmm. they can't handle. So can you speak to that a little bit about stereotypes and some of your experiences on that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you hear over and over again, particularly for folks with an intellectual disability, they won't understand, they can't handle it. We need to protect them. And all of that leads individuals, families, and whatnot not to have these discussions. But I think sometimes more importantly, why we don't have these discussions is because there are very few people in this world who are really comfortable with grief and loss, and it is our own discomfort that sure. prevents us from having these conversations. That's true of, you know, in the general population, absolutely. And when I was doing the work with this agency for 30 years, people were calling me like the death lady because I was truly probably one of the only people in the entire organization who had a level of comfort sitting down and talking to people. Everybody else was just running away as fast as they could from the conversations. And to this day, I'm still asked to come in and have these conversations with people because everybody else is like, oh, I can't do that. And it's not a magical touch. It's just being open and upfront and honest with people. But we don't know how to start the conversations. We don't know how to handle the difficult questions. But certainly, I was just mentioning this, and it's not like I have worked with thousands of people, but in my experience, I have never sat down with someone that I supported that couldn't have these conversations in some way, shape, or form. Certainly, I've had a few people tell me, we don't need to talk about this because I'm never going to die. And it's like, okay, well, so there are other routes you can go to capturing what it is that person might want. But people just assume that you can't find different ways of having conversations, that people can't cope with it. And, you know, I think that's a particular issue when it comes to perhaps people who also don't communicate in the traditional ways, because, you know, we struggle all the time to have alternate communication strategies with people. And there's the assumptions that if you don't communicate traditionally, then you don't understand. And so it's like a double whammy.
That's true. I happen to have a daughter who communicates in the non-ordinary way. And when we had to deal with death, and it was sudden, it was while we were on vacation, when her father died, right? And I recall afterwards so many people asking me the question about how did she cope? And I said, you know, honestly, she was my rock. We held on to each other, not with words, but with energy. We were just energetically connected. We just knew this was something we needed to do, is just be strong for each other. So we just agreed to hold space and get through it. But I know when I think about her exposure to death in general, she had gone to other services. There were, you know, her grandparents, and having to deal with her father having a stroke right in the apartment, it was pretty, you know, shattering for me, never mind her. She just plugged into her music and kept going, right? And just went, this is my escape. Don't take my earbuds out, is all I know. But the whole idea of what are people exposed to, what are we watching their reactions with? So, for example, if you're watching a sad movie, or you're watching something, or there's a book or something that you're sharing with somebody, what are some of those things that you can take advantage of?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that for everyone, again, but particularly for people who struggle a bit more with having these conversations when it is centered on them, most people can still have those conversations either with words or gestures or facial expressions, those ways in which we know or try to know how people are telling us what they're feeling. They will engage secondhand if they won't engage firsthand. So yes, actively actually looking for opportunities to have some discussions, to observe people's reactions, whether that's, you know, in the fall or winter, and having conversations about how, you know, things kind of change with the seasons. When plants die, when you find a dead bird on the side of the street, just having those conversations, trying to have those conversations and doing it, and this is probably the tough piece, doing it in a way that shows that you're comfortable with the topic, because sometimes people don't want to have those conversations because everything in our tone of voice and our body language says, oh, this is not my comfort level. Like, please, please, please don't ask me these questions. I don't want to answer them. So, and I always say, if you're going to tackle this, you first need to figure out how you're going to be comfortable. And if you're not comfortable, then you're not the person to have the conversation, because you will give the impression that it's not okay. It's not okay to talk about grief and loss and death and dying. And not everybody can do that. But you need to first understand where you're at with the particular topics. So watching a sad movie and just having a conversation about that, or, you know, what do you think? What did you, wow, that looked like kind of a fun funeral. Would you do that for your funeral? So looking for those natural opportunities. And starting at a young age, and I think, you know, back to the story about my friend, we hadn't had these conversations because she was pretty young. And so you don't think about having those conversations when someone's younger, but they're conversations you need to have all along the lifespan. This isn't a, boy, now you're at end of life, let's engage in this topic for the first time. I think all of us struggle a bit if we haven't thought about what we want ahead of time. Yeah. Doing that in a crisis doesn't work for people often. It really doesn't work for people. So yeah, I think, you know, and going to funerals, I think about some of the people I've supported, they've probably been to more funerals than I have. They're pros at going to funerals. When we were supporting a number of people who had Alzheimer's disease, once individuals had seen roommates and friends have Alzheimer's disease, it became an easier conversation with them about what was happening to themselves or other friends and family, because they had that concrete experience and could apply it and build their knowledge from that, rather than trying to build knowledge and responses from nothing.
Well, and you know what, you're mentioning experiences. A lot of times when it comes to processing, if you have an intellectual disability, the experience is the most important thing, because you've got nothing to compare it to, mm-hmm. right? And you need the experience to get a sense of, oh, now, I used to say, if you're trying to tell somebody what dragon fruit tastes like, you have to have had other fruit that's similar so you can compare it. But if you've got no comparison, then you've got to find something that will work, you know. And so the whole idea around loss, I know you've mentioned this, that people with an intellectual disability are pros at loss, because staff changeovers, just their lives in general, are often directly impacted and affected with some loss of some sort. It doesn't have to be a person. It can be some other condition or situation or living roommate, or, you know, there's loss involved all the time. And I think some of that loss can be sort of transferred to an understanding of nothing is finite. Not everything evolves. It's the energetic world that we live in, and it just changes, and that's it, right? So I'm not sure where I was going with that question-wise, but the understanding that, or at least that I've come to the understanding that people have a lot more knowledge than we give them credit for.
Yes, and a lot more coping skills.
Yes.
Now, again, I mean, everybody's an individual, but in general, I have often said that the people that I have supported get up and keep going in the face of experiences that would put me down for the count. And it comes from practicing. It comes from going to school and having people pick on you, or not having the opportunity to do the same thing as your classmates. And you either just keep trucking and figure out how to cope with it, or you fold. And I honestly haven't met anybody yet who happens to have an intellectual disability who's folded.
That says a lot.
Yes.
That says there's well, and I think you're right. There is an, if you, and this may be woo-woo for some people, but I'm going to go there anyway. If you decide to come to Earth School and you decide to do it with a disability, the rest of the souls consider you very brave and courageous, because they know at Earth School, this is not an easy journey. Mm-hmm. And I think at the core of who they are, the essence of who they are, whatever how you define that, is pretty darn strong in order to keep up and put up with what they deal with on a regular basis. And so, yes, they are to be admired. They are to be there to learn from, because those kinds of skills can only be learned by observing and thinking, how did you do that? Like, how do you still stand after all that you've gone through? And I can't stand after, you know, someone says something jokingly to me. Whatever, you know,
I spent the next 2 days
ruminating.
Yes. Crying, being upset.
And I think there is this, somebody once referred to Millie as, she does the Tao of Winnie the Pooh well. Mm. And the Tao of Winnie the Pooh is just to be.
Yeah.
Just to be present. And that's a gift when you think about it. How can you be present regardless of where your life's at? And having to deal with the grief and loss. Or, you know, you've got a health condition, so you have to start thinking about the other part of it. When you mentioned a lifespan, so if you were talking to families, like, what would you tell them when their children are younger? Like, what approach would you suggest to them?
Looking for those natural, concrete learning opportunities to engage in a conversation about, you know, grief and loss and death and you know, trying to encourage them thinking about, wow, if that was you, how would you feel about that? Or what would you want to have happened? Mm. Not protecting people from death. Allowing people, not allowing, facilitating people to go to funerals, to participate in rituals. So often, you know, I remember as a child, my grandmother died, and I think many parents do this. My parents wouldn't let me go to the funeral because somehow they thought they were protecting me. And to this day, I remember sitting at home with the babysitter, just being heartbroken that I couldn't go to my grandma's funeral. It's not like I didn't know what funerals were. It's not like I didn't know my grandma was dead. I'm not sure, I guess, didn't want to see, my parents didn't want me to see their grief or other people's grief because somehow we think it will be contagious. Mm. One key lesson is to let people see our grief, to know that our grief is okay, that it's okay to cry, to be sad, to struggle with grief. That gives other people permission to also do that. And if we hide grief and loss, if we prevent people from seeing it, then again, it's kind of like our body language and everything where I was talking about you have to be comfortable with the topic. If you hide people from this, then you give the information that it's not okay, that it's not okay to grieve. I remember once going to a home that were, you know, the people we supported, you know, housemates were there, and their roommate had just died of a heart attack in the hospital. And I went back to tell them that, and I was crying. And one of the ladies said to me, "Why are you crying and I'm not crying? You know, should I be crying?" And I said, "Good no question. No, I'm crying because that's, I cry all the time. So that's my way of expressing myself. Maybe you don't cry. Maybe you're going to experience this in a different way than me. And that's okay, because there's no right way to grieve. And you don't have to cry. But when there are other things you maybe want to do or conversate, like, come back to me." But she was already kind of judging her grief reaction based on mine. And it was like, no, you don't need to cry. Not everybody cries.
Or it takes them a trigger of some sort before they burst into tears, because they've just had to hold it in to cope, right? Yeah. I can identify with that greatly. The other part of it is the time frame. You know, I recall thinking, I want this done in 6 weeks.
Yes.
I'm so funny at times. It only took 9 years before I sort of stepped through it all, but I had other things to deal with in the meantime, so I'm claiming an excuse to that particular part. So the time frame, but also the elements, the stages of grieving, those are helpful to know too, because when you're supporting someone and they're angry, that is grieving too. That is a big part of it. And I only say that because that was my personal experience. I was pretty much pissed off at the world. And everything triggered anger. And it wasn't until I sort of stepped back and went, okay, this isn't going to make you any more friends. It's going to be difficult. So what, you know, how can you move through the anger component of this process? So all of those stages, yes. So you can grieve in sadness and get depressed and stay there for a while, or you can be angry, or you can do the crying, or all of those components. There has to be an awareness, because when people are going through that,
yeah,
you can say, oh, you know, that's grieving. It may not feel that way, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Validate it.
Yes. And grieving isn't a linear journey. And yeah, it isn't time limited. And you may find 2 years down the road or 3 years down the road, you're brushing your teeth in the morning and the tears start to flow. And if you're not supported to recognize that's your grief, then you might be thinking, like, what's wrong with me? But if the people around you also aren't aware of your life history, so, you know, life stories and whatnot, we may tend, when we're helping people to build their life stories, to also skirt around the loss pieces. And they're so important, particularly when someone can't tell us.
Yeah, that's like skirting around the sex topic, really.
Yes. And so if somebody can't say, you know, in 1995, somebody made me move out of my apartment and put me in a group home, you know, in August of 1995, then August of 2022, when this person is just having a heck of a rough time, you won't know that that may be related to that loss experience so many years ago. We lose people's grief histories. And again, when people can't tell us, wow, this really horrible thing. I think about another lady I supported who every August for like a 2 week period of time, it was like, who is this person? And she couldn't identify. She was kind of saying like, who am I? I'm being horrible to people. I'm fighting with people. And finally, through some conversation with family, we didn't get the details, but she'd gone to camp 1 year in August.
Okay.
So, you know, she couldn't share with us, but we kind of said, we think maybe something really horrible happened to you at camp in August. And maybe that's some of what you're experiencing. And I believe that her August got a little bit better after that, because we could help her maybe put words or help her pinpoint, you know, we couldn't help figure out what happened to her.
At least identify the reason for the feeling,
yeah,
that was arising. And that's very valuable, because that's a trigger, and grieving is a trigger. Like, yeah, it is, like, you can be in the supermarket, it'll be 5 years later, and all of a sudden you see, and somebody told me this, this actually happened to them. They saw their father's favorite cookies. They hadn't seen them for a while. And she said, there I am in the shopping aisle crying.
Yeah.
Just like sobbing. She said, I felt so out of place.
Yeah.
But I knew it was the cookies that did the trigger. And so at least she knew. But if you don't know, you're not mindful of what that trigger, where that came from, like the August thing.
Yeah.
And the other part of it is too, I think we can encourage people. We acknowledge that that's a tough time and this is a difficult time to go through, but help people build a different story.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to hang on to the pain. You can look for elements of the grief that when you remember, it's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like, there's duality.
Like, you survived.
You survived it. Yeah. Like, there's two stories to everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's the whole polarity of life, unfortunately. And if you can figure out that there are two sides and you can accept that, it's a little easier to, you know, say, no, I don't want that story. I'm going to take this story and heal myself.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And, you know, I also want to say, you're talking about the person crying in the aisle. We still tend, when it comes to someone with an intellectual disability, to just label it as behaviors, right? Mm. Oh, it's just a behavior. They're acting out.
It's language, and
we don't step back to take a look to say, and it could be a million different things, right? Grief might be just one of 50 different reasons, but, you know, looking and making sure that we consider that grief and loss might play a role in what this person's trying to communicate to us, and not just say, I've also heard, you know, people say, well, you know, their mom died a year ago, like, and they're still crying about it. They need to get over it. And it's like, no, they don't. If you can't find the patience or the empathy to listen to the story, you need to find someone who can.
And maybe that person who is thinking, oh, get over it, hasn't really had any grief themselves.
Yeah.
They, you know, that's a gap in their own life, and there's nothing for them to compare it to.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never experienced grief, and it could be something like a loss of a pet, which can be a huge thing, and it just is as equal as far as the grief goes sometimes as someone else, you know, a human mm-hmm. being, depending on what the relationship was, you know. The cat may have given you more love than your yeah. brother did. Who knows?
Yeah.
I want to go back to the story of the example that you gave where this woman had just not the best health condition happening and losing, you know, being recommended that you can lose your feet and your arms and your legs or whatever it was. It sounded like the worst possible scenario. I'm curious as to how you helped her find a way to talk about what she wanted or developed a way of understanding.
Yeah, so she was never able to be part. She was sedated, you know, until a decision could be made. So what happened is that her support network, the group of people who had known her well and long-term, together with the help of an ethicist, just went through, okay, what do we know about this woman and how she has chosen to live her life up to now, what she's valued up until now, what has been essential to her at her core, and what we now know would be, if she even survived coming out of sedation and having the intubation removed, what would her life be? And is that a life she would have chosen if we had actually had these conversations with her before this happened? And, you know, just this was a woman who fought long and hard through her whole life, spent many years in a group living arrangement, and clearly indicated that it did not work for her, that she was fiercely independent. When she had to live with other people and receive supports from a bunch of staff she didn't know or trust, it put her in a position of having to act or react in a way that felt horrible to her, did not reflect well on her. She was forced to be a person she didn't want to be. And when she was able to move out and live in a model that gave her control and choice and where she could be as independent as possible, and she was the driver of the bus, she became the person she had always wanted to be. And we knew that if she woke up with no feet, no hands, on dialysis, she would have been, what we said, she'd be so mad at us. She'd be so mad at us, because that would not have been the life she chose. And so the decision finally was made to remove her from life support, but to not go through with having her limbs amputated, and she died. She received palliative care and she died.
I love the way you describe the process of what her, who would she be?
Yeah.
And knowing somebody is just so valuable for mm-hmm. those circumstances. However, if you have the conversation earlier,
yes,
you'd be ahead of the game a little bit and not feel the pressure
yeah.
of supporting someone and having to decide.
Yeah.
Because I've heard you say this, and if you want to expound on this, it'd be great. that's a human right mm-hmm. to decide how we will end our lives,
yes.
whether or not someone else agrees or not.
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, so it's a basic human right. When you talk to anybody, I think, who is, I mean, choice and control is key to each and every one of us in how we live our lives and our experiences of our lives. And why would we then take all of that away at the end of our life? We all want some control. We want to be able to say, you don't get to decide how I live the last days or months of my life. Unfortunately, for I think the vast majority of people, the medical community gets to decide how we live the end of our lives. I just finished reading this really interesting book, and I can't remember the title of it, written by an ICU doctor who's really struggling with how the medical community still has control over end-of-life decisions for people and how we use technology sometimes to keep people alive well past the point in which that person would even have chosen that. But again, if you don't plan in advance, then you have families who struggle trying to figure out, and there's the emotional. So if you don't want, honestly, we don't want to let go of the people we love. So if you don't want to let go of the person you love, then sometimes the decisions you are making are about you and not about them.
Yes.
And it's a right. It's a right to say, not only here's how I live my life, but here's how I finish my life. Whether you agree or not, this is my choice and my decision. When we talk about advanced care planning, and I mentioned about doing funeral planning with people, there are also people who say, I don't want a funeral. And lots of people who don't want to respect or, you know, but if somebody says, I really don't want this, then at least it opens the conversation for how could we then mark your passing. What would be okay with you?
Yeah, because it's really about us when yes. someone dies. It's really about how do we close the memory of who they were in a way that's, you know, in a little box, because we like little boxes.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's a bad thing,
nope.
but it really, I always find that if someone says, I don't want a funeral, I'll go, well, what's the ritual for me
right.
to let you go then?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'll still hang on to your energy and the love and everything.
Yeah.
But what's the ritual
yeah.
so I can let you go? Because
yeah.
it's important.
Yes. And I think about my friend's mom who said, I don't want a funeral to me. And I said, because I could have those conversations. And I said to her, yeah, Dot, it's not about you then, you're dead. But your family is going to need something. And she said, yeah, I never thought about it that way. And I don't know if anybody else, because I just have had so many, would have had maybe the comfort level to say to someone, because she was nearing end of life, right?
Yes.
To say, yeah, you'll be dead. It's irrelevant. You're going to be somewhere else at that point. What's the big deal?
It's like, why do you care?
Yes.
And it's true. And I know my father-in-law didn't want a service, but those of us who were still around went, well, you know what? We didn't hear that. We're still going to have one.
Yeah.
It was a little one, but we still had one, right?
Yeah.
And I know that was sort of like, I don't know, did we disrespect? But no, we needed the closure. It was important to us. So I guess those are the kinds of things that people may or may not do. And it's okay. You know, it's just one of those things that you decide based on what you're dealing with. And sometimes if you, as you're describing the situation that you had to process, if you haven't had any conversations, if you really don't know that person, the only lens you have is your own. And that may not be a good fit for someone
nope.
at all.
Yeah.
You know, 2017, we were in Jamaica, and it was the last day we were in the mountains. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning before the music from the distance started. It was great music. It was a little bit different than what we'd been hearing. And I said, I wonder where that's coming from, right? And it wasn't until we left and we were driven and we said, hey, we heard this music all night. And when it started to rain, it stopped. And the driver who lived in the mountains said, oh, that was a funeral.
Mm.
That's a Jamaican tradition. You go to the cemetery and you dance and you drink and you have a great time. And I went, I want a Jamaican funeral.
Yeah.
That sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
So now that I've recorded that, and so family, are you listening?
Yeah.
You don't have to go to Jamaica to do it, you know. You can, but it was just about the party part of it, you know?
Yeah.
As we've been having this conversation, is there anything that you'd like to add that you think you might have missed in the questions that I raised?
I don't think so, except this whole topic, we've kind of focused a lot on grief and loss, which is important, but the whole topic of advanced care planning is not something that's been embraced across the board. The vast majority of people never tackle advanced care planning. I make up statistics. There could be completely inaccurate, but let me say 50% of people don't have wills, 75% of people don't. And if you do funeral planning, it's about buying that plot in the cemetery, but it's not about how I want my life to be celebrated or remembered, or, you know, who do I want to say.
What songs do you want to have?
Yeah. And there's something, this is going to sound a little warped, there's something kind of fun about that. And in fact, in doing funeral planning with some of the folks I supported, some of them really got into it. It was like, oh yeah, I want this song and that song, and I want little fancy round sandwiches afterwards and brownie cake. And it takes some of the fear, I think, out of the whole idea of dying, and it becomes, well, I'm kind of planning the big party. I want lots of people there. I want them to say nice things about me.
It's the final transition.
Yes. And so it was, and then those people who said, I'm not going to die. I had a friend who happened to have Alzheimer's disease, and she had never wanted, even when her dad and mom had died, she really had not been all that open to conversations around death and dying. And I knew, okay, both her parents are dead now. I have some responsibility here to capture what she would want. Then I just said, you know what, planning my funeral. And I'm not sure what it should look like, but you know me really well. What would you, if you come to my funeral, what do you want it to be like? And she planned my funeral for me. And I wrote it all down, and that was her funeral plan.
That is such a great approach. I love it.
Yeah.
Because it takes the pressure off thinking about yourself.
Yes.
And the pressure off thinking about death.
Yeah.
But it's always easier to advocate for someone else, to plan for someone else, to do lots of things for someone else, because you don't have to think about your own stuff.
So should I be cremated or buried in a casket? Oh, no, you don't be buried in a casket, because the things will get through and eat you and bugs and stuff. And I was like, oh, okay, no, I'm going to be cremated then. And so I knew, okay, absolutely she needs to be cremated when she dies, because she would be horrified to know she's been buried in the ground somewhere. And I think about, again, the concrete learner. One of the ladies I supported went to a funeral once where the coffin was not open. And certainly, you know, in the good old days, I think the vast majority, maybe, of funerals, there was an open coffin. So the first funeral she went to without an open coffin, she had a heck of a time wrapping around her head around the fact that the person was dead. And it was 30 below, and they were going to put the casket in the ground, and she was insisting she wanted to go, and people were telling her, it's too cold, you can't be out there. And I said, no, she has to go, because that is what she's going to need to understand that the person, because she's asked me 5 times now where they are, because she hasn't, you know, gotten a ritual yet that helps her to solidify that. And so, out she went, 30 below, freezing her buns off. But once that casket went into the ground, that was what helped her to understand this person was dead and now buried.
Right, the final ritual that sort of said, I get it.
Yeah. So it is, it's the rituals, whatever. And people's rituals are going to be as individual as they are as well.
That's right. I like the fact that you brought up that even though it's a made-up statistic, but I would guess it's probably not far, that so many of us don't have a will, a last will and testament, that we haven't had the conversation. So if you are listening and you don't have one, go do that.
Yes.
Find a lawyer.
Yeah.
Because it simplifies those of us who have to look after you die.
Yeah.
Our lives are quite complicated if you don't do that.
Yes.
And I know my family, my parents set the precedence. They had prepaid their lot. They prepaid pretty much everything over a period of time. And my brother did the same. He didn't do the cremation part, but when I went to the funeral home, they said, oh, your brother's prepaid the marker. And I went, thank goodness, because I know just the cremation is going to set me back.
Right.
You know, I wasn't sure how much he had, if he had done anything. So it took the pressure off. It takes an enormous amount of pressure off to do some of that pre-planning.
Yeah.
The wills, whether, you know, where do you want your ashes or your body to go? Like, those aren't complicated. And if you don't want to talk about it, write it down somewhere.
Yes.
They'll find it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a massive unknown. Is simpler for those of us who have to deal with it afterwards.
Yeah. And my friend, you know, who we decided to remove the life-sustaining technology from her, we also had not had a conversation about where she wanted her ashes to go. And as I said, she hadn't, her relationship with her family had been very, very complicated. But thankfully, we had gone with her many times to her mom's plot in the cemetery. And we knew where her mom was buried, how important that was to her. But boy, was that a heck of a process to try and arrange to have her ashes placed in the same plot as her mom. We were pretty clear that's what she would want, but all the hoops, because we weren't family, and all the hoops we had to jump through. And again, if we'd gone through that with her, and she would certainly have engaged in that and been really excited about that idea, we wouldn't have had to go through all of that.
It could have all been done by her, you know, as the primary person needing the space.
Yeah. And thank goodness we'd been going, because her mom had died years. Like, if we had not been in her life and she hadn't invited us to go to the cemetery with her to visit her mom's plot, we wouldn't have even known where to begin to figure out where her mom was buried. Like, it would have been even worse. And it's important. It was important to us in our grief process that we honor her to the best of our ability, to try and honor her wishes. And that whole in the end, as ghoulish as this may sound, we felt good about the decisions we'd made. But boy, what an agonizing process. And questioning ourselves, and even, you know, feeling good about it and then going, oh, did we do the right thing? Like, you don't want to have to live with that if you don't have to.
That's right, yeah. And I think that's a really great note to sort of wrap it up on. It's that think about or give some serious thought to how you can support someone in that process of what would you like to happen when you get close to your end of life. Sooner the better.
Yeah.
Because we all know it takes a little bit longer for people to understand the process, right, or to give some thought to it. You can't start having a conversation that's got a heaviness to it and expect them to grasp and respond in a week. No, this is like over a period of years maybe, you know, and it's around the relationship and what that relationship is like and how comfortable that is. So I would just encourage people to think about it and do the planning themselves. Get comfortable with their own.
Yes.
Because once once you start thinking about it for yourself, you realize it is valuable. You may not want other people to make decisions. Like, I have friends who've said, please, you know, do not have a church service or don't take me to that particular spot.
Yeah.
If they never said that, the possibility was that that's exactly what would happen, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's absolutely the most valuable thing that we can do to help people wrap up their lives in a way that takes the pressure off of them, because they can say, I'm set.
Yes.
I know what I can live fully knowing
yeah.
that I have plans on how it will end.
Yes.
And that's the same for all of us.
Yeah. And that, you know, and that ties kind of like to palliative care, which is really you support people not necessarily to die. You support them to live the way they want to the last moment.
So here's to supporting everyone to live a good life.
Yes, for sure.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Leslie and I talk about end-of-life planning. If it helps you in any way to better understand and cope with some of your own potentially difficult conversations, then that adds meaning for us. Now, we're not suggesting an immediate Swedish death clearing, although check it out. It's an interesting practice, certainly one we can all learn from. If you have any questions or would like more information about end-of-life planning, resources that we might have, anything on the community-based assisted decision-making pilot project or the legislative changes, you can call us toll-free 1-866-516-5445. You can email us at info@icof-life.ca, or if you prefer, visit our website, innovativelifeoptions.ca. Thanks for listening. And if you want, keep the conversation going.